Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. Today, we present History's Hotties, Episode 9, Would the Real Scarlet Please Stand Up? So we, this week, are beginning a new series, The Myth of the Mistress, the Plantation Mistress, that is. If you remember the show about the brides of the Chesapeake, young girls intended as brides for farmers went for about 120 pounds of leaf tobacco. And these women were quite a commodity. Even the Maryland legislature stated publicly that women were vital to the success of the running of a plantation. The North and South diverged as slavery became a Southern institution. An absolute patriarchy became a necessity to ensure the subjugation of an entire race of the population in the opinion of the slaveholders. Thus, the society of the South was born and balanced very delicately between the dream and the reality. What the patriarchy wanted you to believe was what their society was like and what it was really like. And thus we are introduced to this week's History's Hottie, the Plantation Mistress. We will begin with an overview, a girl's life before marriage and what her daily life was really like after marriage. And then in our next episode, we'll get a little more into the nitty gritty of some interesting parts of lives that, you know, the sordid details that everybody likes to hear about. You know, I know sometimes in your history books, that part of history is avoided. But I think it's an interesting and important part of history because I think it tells us a lot about the context from which people are coming from. So today we will, like I said, talk about before marriage and daily life. And then later on we'll get kind of into some of the nitty gritty of relationships between husbands and wives and things like that. So I will insert here that when we refer to the planter class, most historians are referring to farms with 20 or more slaves, which made up about 12% of the slaveholding households, according to Laura Edwards, the author of Scarlet Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which is a fabulous book. I recommend you pick it up if you find this topic interesting. We have talked about marriage in many of our previous episodes, but this might be a good opportunity to share the reason for the name of the podcast again. When people began coming to the New World, though many of the old social constraints of the Old World came with them, the roughness of the New World, along with the absence of a structure of nobility, allowed and necessitated that women become very involved in the survival of families and communities. Thus, women were very influential in American history, but were often overlooked for their contributions beyond giving birth to the influential men of the nation. So History's Hotties is a play on the idea that women had a great role that the had a greater role than the young, desirable bride who becomes the mother of this man's children. And the reality of the Southern Belle is a great example of this irony. Let's not be naive. Women often knew how to work the idea of the Southern Belle. But really, the only time Scarlet showed up was for a short time after a girl was presented to society and until she was married. Then we will see from many of the writings left from this era that the real life of the plantation mistress was quite different than this myth of Scarlet. Unmarried girls were rarely allowed off the plantation, and for the same reason that few slaves lived in cities like Harriet Jacobs, few Southern girls had opportunities to meet more than just a few neighbors and their cousins. These vast fields and poor roads separated farms, so there just wasn't a lot of opportunity to meet. It wasn't, you know, daily calling like you might see in a movie, and it certainly wasn't, you know, if you've ever read the book The Age of Innocence, you know, calling in the mornings was a very important part of their day. Well, these women didn't have an opportunity to do that. Men married later than women, mostly because they needed to establish themselves before they could recommend themselves to a young lady's father as a suitable mate, which is kind of funny that you have to recommend yourself as a suitable mate. Girls often married cousins, not only because families wanted to hold on to their wealth, but girls would rather marry a cousin they knew than a wealthy stranger their father wanted them to marry. Of course, this was not the case for poorer farming families, but for the purposes of today's podcast, we are going to talk about the planter class, those that had enough wealth to make following social customs necessary. This period of courtship, though, was the freest time in a young woman's life. Southern girls were usually married off early, and it seems to be that a big reason for this was the intense fear of racial mixing. Again, we're back to the patriarchal society and the control of men in this society. While many white men had female slaves as sexual partners, they were very afraid that Southern women might take a male slave as a lover, which then established the custom of youthful marriage for females, while men, I said before, married older. Usually a father was pretty anxious to marry off his daughter soon after puberty. Courtship was very formal, and young girls were expected to refuse any first attempt at a proposal out of propriety. The northern custom of bundling, where couples were wrapped in covers, and often the man was stitched so tightly that the couple could share a bed, was not observed, and it was hard for young men to find a way to discover if a young lady really liked him. Some young men were creative and sent other girls over to talk to a belle to find out how she might really feel, but the craziest story I have heard about how a young man found a way to spend time with this young woman and steal a kiss was by putting laudanum in a peach and giving it to her while they were engaged, because the rules of courtship were so strict, which this seems really creepy to me, and it doesn't really say a lot about his being concerned about her health. He did this to steal a kiss. Young women would also go through a third party sometimes to let a man know that she was interested in having him pursue her. When a man was actually serious, a father often expected a written declaration, which served two purposes. The young man was supposed to use this opportunity to show on paper that he could support a family, and it could also be used as evidence of wrongdoing if the young man withdrew his proposal later. And there were some lawsuits over that kind of thing, where, you know, a young man might propose and a woman, you know, wasn't out in society and now she's, you know, getting a year older or whatever, and then he withdraws his proposal, he meets somebody else he likes more. Anyway, and there were lawsuits occasionally over things like that. But yeah, but the guy who put laudanum in the peach, he definitely doesn't go down in history as the most noble sort of fellow from this era. This sort of follows the British custom more during the 18th century, where the declaration of intention to marry was often made publicly, and social custom really discouraged someone changing their mind unless some piece of information that showed poor character, most often of the female, surfaced. There were elopements when parents did not approve of a potential marriage partner, and the couple usually hoped that the parents would forgive them after the fact. One story told by a Southern belle showed why a father might be so careful with his unmarried daughter with these declarations and with a gentleman's behavior and all that sort of thing. Gertrude Clanton was educated as a Southern lady. She slept late in the mornings, and she read, and she wrote in her diary when she was young. And she was sent to a female college, which was really a finishing school, and socialized in Southern cities where the young men convened. And she really believed in this idea of romantic love. That was until she visited a cousin who had thrown off convention and married for love and is now living in a small cabin with a dirt floor. In this era, living conditions were harsh for those who did not have money, and thrift was necessary even in the planter households with 20 or more slaves. So the line between a big house, and if you've seen pictures of plantations, you'll see that not all of the big houses were as majestic as the Gone with the Wind image, and living in a cabin without a dirt floor could be pretty blurry. So Gertrude was horrified. And of course, we will discuss also the women of the working class in a later episode who grew up in the South. They had a completely different life, and how they felt about Southern aristocracy in the Civil War was different. But Gertrude just getting a glimpse into that life was just really startling to her. So, but back to the mythical Scarlet. If the wedding was not an elopement, the whole family attended, offering an opportunity for other unmarried people to pair up. So young women had constraints on their behavior and ability to pick a husband, but for this brief period, she had just a little power as young men wooed her before she was expected to defer to him in all things. As of the day of the wedding, the game changed. While flowery love letters were common and love matches were not totally unheard of, the reality was often different. Wealthy women of Europe in earlier years had expected infidelity and often ignored it, but in this period where romantic love was kind of taking a foothold in women's minds, women did often protest over infidelity, especially if the other woman was white. While women stayed close to home and other white women were not around a lot, a master did travel on business during the year. But because news spread from trading areas where a relative or a friend of a relative might live, wives often found out about the women their husbands may have had an affair with. Military service and political office might also take a man away from home for extended periods. And though the wives might complain, this rarely swayed men in their attempts to gain political power, which could actually help the growth of their farm as well. The solution for this might be that the wife traveled with him, but women often complained as well about this because of the long separations from their families. Divorce was rare, but sometimes granted if the woman was abandoned or beaten, but a man was more likely to be granted a divorce for a wife's infidelity than a woman would be granted one for any reason. A child fathered by another man might make a forgivable situation unforgivable. There were men who would take their wife back, but if she had a child by another man, that was usually a deal breaker. There was sympathy among the southern aristocracy for incompatible marriage, and the few divorces that were granted, contrary to popular belief, were usually not met with being completely shut out from society. The woman had no legal right to her children, so a woman knew that if she chose to leave, she might face leaving her children with a carousing husband that she didn't even want to live with. But we will extensively cover moral behavior and the sexual double standards for men and women in part two of this podcast. I just wanted to give you a little bit of an overview because I think it explains a lot about what was going on in these households at the time. I continue to come across tales that shock me every time I read about this subject, even though I have been studying the sort of the myth of the plantation mistress for a long time. So there'll be some good stories. So back to women's work. Often when women did not know about the business of the plantation, it was because their husbands were shielding them from debt problems or other business issues considered too complicated for women, or sometimes because the husband was ashamed that he was having trouble supporting his wife and family. But for all the effort men put out trying to keep women in their proper sphere, the actual day-to-day running of a plantation did not reflect the myth of Scarlet at all, especially before the war. Now we see, if you have read or seen Gone with the Wind, you see that after the war she comes back to the plantation and she is in the dirt and she is digging and she is working. That also was kind of a myth. You know, the plantation mistress was probably not, you know, hoeing the ground, even though she may have been after the war. But, so we don't really see an accurate reflection at all in this movie and or in the book. Large plantations might have an overseer, and slaves did work the field on these types of farms, but this did not mean that the mistress of the plantation was idle. She oversaw the planning and management of the house as well as food production, which included the dairy, the garden, the smokehouse, as well as the clothing for the family and the slaves, and other details considered too trite for the master himself to deal with. I mentioned thrift before, and it was very important. This really shows just how life would have been difficult for the working class if it was necessary for these people who owned all these slaves and, you know, could live in a house with multiple rooms, you know, what life would have been like for the actual working people if life was tough for the planter class. Food was doled out very carefully, as were items like cloth and candles, even on large farms. Families that lived in opulence were few and far between, so good management was critical, making the plantation mistress as important as those men in the Maryland legislature had jokingly indicated. Young brides were moved onto existing plantations with only the advice of their aunt or their mother, but little training, which seems shocking and kind of silly, considering if they had been left a motherless teenage girl at home or had been a spinster, they would have been expected to step into the mistress role for their families. But the desire to make daughters seem like the perfect belle both protected her and set her up for misery at the same time. She would be too far from the next big house to visit the closest neighboring mistress regularly, and she was really far too busy in her own house to do much visiting anyway. Her education did not teach her how to administer medical care to the slaves, which she was expected to do, manage the household budget, get a garden to grow in any kind of conditions, make candles, make soap, weave rugs, weave bed linens, fill a straw tick, which is a mattress, by the way, or care for her children. Canning and storage, as well as processing meat for the winter, and tasks like making quills into pens, fell on the shoulders of these mistresses. Yet when her husband left on a long business trip, she had to manage the farm herself at the same time. She was warned by her husband not to speak politically. Many husbands would write while they were away, criticizing their wives on the price they had gotten for their wheat or their cotton. Yet they would leave for extended periods and expect their wives to constantly come up with ways to be more efficient in running the plantation. It was considered inappropriate to educate a girl in the same way as educating a boy, but she was expected to do all the bookkeeping for the plantation, which was a full-fledged business with complicated expenses, yet she had to ask her husband if she wanted money for dresses or supplies or anything like that. As the seasons changed, the list of necessary chores did as well. Spring cleaning meant doing things like scalding the beds to prevent bed bugs, cleaning the copper pots to prevent metal poisoning, and overhauling the house. Cloth production on smaller plantations was sometimes handled by the slaves, but on larger plantations took a great deal of the mistress's time. I still haven't really found a good historical explanation for why the mistress on a larger plantation would have more responsibilities for cloth production than a smaller one, but I've seen it written a couple of different places, so I'm still doing some research on that. Sometimes the overseer's wife might take over this duty, but as we have discussed, not all plantations had an overseer. In fact, we know that only about 30% of the plantations with 100 or more slaves employed an overseer. And in the absence of the master, the mistress was in charge of the entire farm. So, as we can see, while movies depicting this period might give the impression that the plantation mistress only received guests each day as the household slaves performed all of these chores, this was simply not the case in most households. I do not want to give the impression as well that the slaves were not doing the brunt of the dirty work, such as the laundry or emptying the chamber pots on the plantation as well, or that some mistresses did not severely treat their house slaves. I think the stories of the doctor's wife told by Harriet Jacobs in her book, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, show that they certainly did do all of these things, but often their anger towards the house slaves came from a different place. The absolute patriarchy we have discussed that was common in the South came from a belief that everyone in society must see the master as the end-all be-all for power and wisdom, which explains why even some of the ministers of the day preached submission to the master from the pulpit, as well as this fear that white women might choose a slave for a bed partner, while at the same time she was keenly aware that her husband was likely fathering children by slave women and she had little recourse. This is, you know, why this existed. The power balance, they believed, was so delicate, therefore it was necessary. So often, this mistress's anger was directed at the victims, both trying to keep slaves in line, and slaves would often misbehave when the master was gone because the mistress, who did not have a grown son to help, really could not wield a whip like her husband, and to try in some way to keep the slave girl from becoming the object of her husband's desire, as if these slave girls had any choice in the matter, and as if these slaves somehow, you know, were misbehaving because they were getting out of line and not because they just wanted freedom. So your plantation mistress and your slave both wanted freedom. And again, I'm not saying that they were in the same place, because they weren't. The submission and the patriarchy was different for both of them, but neither one of them in this society was really truly free. The life on this plantation was hard, but it was in the woman's best interest to learn about the family business, because if she became a widow, which was likely if she lived through the births of her children, being ignorant of the day-to-day operations of the plantation was terrible, and the crash course in plantation management could be a disaster. Legally, she had little control. Socially, she had little control. And physically, she had absolutely no control. She was at the mercy of her father, husband, uncle, grown son, etc. Yet the idea of the helpless, beautiful woman who would be the simple but moral center of the home is a myth. The real Scarlett is here, but she is too busy working to be idly listening to this podcast today. So this is our episode for this week. In our second episode of The Mythical Scarlett, we will discuss more about the real lives and times of the plantation mistress, the sordid details of her struggle, and how her life changed when the Civil War began. So, if you have any questions, comments, or snide remarks, all of which we accept, please contact me at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties@yahoo.com. And until next time.